Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The UN says violence and abuses in Libya are getting worse, and fighting pushes South Sudan toward famine. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The United Nations Human Rights Office has denounced the worsening violence in the eastern part of Libya, especially in Benghazi. It says killings, human rights abuses, and other forms of repression are escalating at an alarming pace. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office has condemned the recent murder of the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross sub-delegation in Misrata, Libya. It sees this as one of the latest examples of a country in which impunity reigns, a situation that allows assassinations to happen and human rights abuses to grow. Spokesman Rupert Colville says people in Libya, especially in Benghazi, are being killed and injured because no legal restraints are put on the perpetrators. He says people know they can get away with the crimes they commit. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Food Program warns fighting and lack of access to the displaced in South Sudan are pushing the country towards a hunger catastrophe. The World Food Program says this humanitarian disaster still can be prevented, but time is running out. Before fighting erupted in mid-December between the government and rebels, 140,000 people in South Sudan were suffering from severe food shortages. Now, a World Food Program spokeswoman says that number stands at 1.3 million. But that seems unlikely. A second truce enacted between the warring factions on May 9th broke down not long after it was signed. Italy says it has rescued around 2,500 asylum seekers from the Mediterranean during a 24-hour period, most of them departing from North Africa. The Navy said today that 157 children were among the migrants who had been brought to shore since Thursday, many of them in overcrowded boats. Officials say good weather conditions apparently prompted the asylum seekers to make the perilous journey. Italy is the main gateway to Europe for African and Middle Eastern migrants seeking to escape war, poverty, and political turmoil. One of Afghanistan's two final contenders for the presidency, Abdullah Abdullah, narrowly escaped a bomb attack today. Sharon Bain reports from Islamabad that Taliban militants have vowed to derail the June 14th runoff vote.
Presidential frontrunner Abdullah Abdullah had just left a political gathering in the capital, Kabul, when his convoy was hit by a double bombing. Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui describes the attack.
There has been a terrorist attack today in Kabul, and the city of a campaign rally going on by one of the candidates. The campaign was over and they were out on the way. They came under the attack by a terrorist, a suicide bomber.
A second bomb went off near the car. The Ministry of Interior says six civilians died and 22 were wounded in the attack. President Hamid Karzai condemned the bombings. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the blasts. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
China is rejecting a report by the U.S. Defense Department that suggested Beijing significantly underestimated the amount it spent on defense last year. The annual Pentagon report to Congress Thursday said Chinese military spending was about $140 billion in 2013. That's about 20% more than the $119.5 billion China said it spent. The Defense Department document also noted Beijing is expanding its ability to project power overseas. That sound from D-Day celebrations in Normandy. The White House says U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke briefly at the D-Day commemoration ceremonies in France, despite estrangement over Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. The White House said the two men had an informal conversation today that lasted about 15 minutes during a lunch hosted by French President François Hollande. The U.S. unemployment rate held steady at 6.3% last month, and the economy had a net gain of 217,000 jobs. Today's report from the Labor Department is more evidence that the economy may be regaining momentum after foul winter weather slowed growth for the first few months of this year. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
After a murderous rampage this week killed nearly 350 people in northern Nigeria, residents say Boko Haram militants are holding villages hostage and appear to be preparing to attack larger towns. Some analysts say for the government to defeat Boko Haram, it needs to stop treating the conflict like an insurgency and start fighting a real war.
That's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details next.
Also in the news, Italy says it has rescued around 2,500 asylum seekers from the Mediterranean during a 24-hour period, most of them departing from North Africa.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, after a murderous rampage this week killed nearly 350 people in northern Nigeria, residents say Boko Haram militants are holding villages hostage and appear to be preparing to attack larger towns. Some analysts say for the government to defeat Boko Haram, it needs to stop treating the conflict like an insurgency and starting fighting a real war. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
By the time villagers knew Boko Haram militants had invaded Bardari on Wednesday night, it was too late to run into the bush and hide. The militants told the people they were there to preach Islam, not to kill, and the crowd fearfully gathered by the mosque. Boko Haram had already attacked six villages earlier in the week, killing at least 300 people. Once the people were gathered by the mosque, the militants opened fire, killing 45 people before razing the village and stealing the livestock. Abba Abdulmumini is a community leader in Borno State, one of three Nigerian states that have been under emergency rule for more than a year.
The emergency rule is not effective. It has not prevented anything from happening. In fact, it's worsening the situation.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan said Thursday that very soon Boko Haram will be history, before blaming opposition politicians for the insurgency. But community leaders in the north say the militants are growing stronger and are believed to have occupied villages and hoisted flags. They warn the insurgents appear to be setting their sights on overthrowing local governments. Late last month, the president declared total war against Boko Haram insurgents. This comes at a time where there is enormous pressure on Nigeria's leaders to beat back insurgents who have been holding more than 200 schoolgirls hostage for nearly 2 months. The abduction sparked nationwide protests and prompted the international community to provide material and logistical help. But the girls remain missing. And attacks continue nearly every day. University of Abuja criminology professor Femi Odekonle says declaring war against insurgents is not enough.
You have a war on your hand and you act accordingly that you have a real war, whether you call it insurgency, whether you call it Boko Haram, whatever. You have to attend to it.
He says the military is overstretched without the personnel or the weapons to beat Boko Haram, which is increasingly well-armed. In 5 years of insurgency, thousands of people have been killed, including more than 2,000 this year alone. Odekunle says there will never be long-term peace until larger issues, such as acute social inequality and corruption, are addressed. He compares Nigeria's governance to a dirty river.
If you have in a place, a river that is flowing, and the river is carrying communicable diseases, there is bad sanitation, there is a bad hygiene, you should expect over time there will be consequences in terms of cholera, in terms of other diseases.
Boko Haram says it wants to create an Islamic State and destroy the Nigerian government. However, the only way the group communicates with the public is through videos that feature Abubakar Shekau, a man who says he leads the insurgency and speaks like a cartoon villain. Boko Haram's lack of clear vision, constantly changing tactics, and increasingly powerful weaponry has led many regional analysts to conclude that the group has more than its harsh version of Islamic law on the agenda. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
The Emir of Kano, a major Islamic authority in northern Nigeria and a critic of Boko Haram, died this morning at the age of 83. No cause of death has been reported. Ado Abdullahi Bayero served for 50 years as the 13th Fulani Emir. He was Nigeria's second highest Islamic authority and a reverend and a revered figure in the nation's largely Muslim north. He also served as Nigeria's ambassador to Senegal, chancellor of the Universities of Nigeria and Ibadan, and Kano police chief. In January 2013, the Emir's convoy was attacked and four of his bodyguards were killed. Although his palace spokesman said the Emir was not injured, he was flown to London for treatment shortly afterward. Last Friday, the Emir of Guazo, Al-Hali Idrissa Tamita, was killed in an attack on his convoy. Boko Haram is suspected to have mounted both attacks, but no group has publicly taken responsibility.
The UN Human Rights Office is denouncing the increasing violence in eastern Libya, especially in Benghazi. It says killings, human rights abuses, and other forms of repression are escalating at an alarming pace. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the Rights Office in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office has condemned the recent murder of the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross subdelegation in Misrata, Libya. It sees this as one of the latest examples of a country in which impunity reigns, a situation that allows assassinations to happen and human rights abuses to grow. Spokesman Rupert Colville says people in Libya, especially in Benghazi, are being killed and injured because no legal restraints are put on the perpetrators. He says people know they can get away with the crimes they commit.
The government effectively is unable to exercise control over a large number of armed brigades. It's a major concern. The government doesn't have effective control over the whole country at all. Assassinations and other attacks systematically target state officials themselves and facilities belonging to the state, particularly in the east. So it's a very, very messy situation.
Colville says different armed groups are involved in these attacks and violations. He says they should be answerable to the law. But while there are laws on the books, he says they are not being implemented. He says Libya's judicial system is broken. He says he does not know how many people are being killed, but he notes hardly a week goes by without bombings or without an attack by armed groups of men ambushing and killing innocent people. Beyond the deteriorating security concerns, he says there are many human rights concerns.
For example, 7,000 people who continue to be deprived of their liberty without regard for due process. There's been UNSMIL reports on torture and other ill treatment in detention facilities. The issues relating to the detention of refugees and migrants transiting through Libya. Again, around 7,000 believed to be detained often in very poor conditions. Some of them have been detained for 3 years.
Colville says the condition of people detained in government-run facilities is also far from ideal. The United Nations published a report late last year focusing on the situation of torture and deaths in detention throughout Libya. Colville notes the government, unlike the armed groups named, has responded to the report and has been making an effort to improve this deplorable situation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Libya has much of the world's highest quality crude oil, but since the fall of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, production has been sporadic and on the decline. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
After assessing Libya's political instability, violence, and armed groups battling for control, John Kingston sums up prospects for the country's oil industry this way.
There's essentially no good news there.
Kingston is director of news for Platts, which provides information on the global energy, petrochemical, metals, and agriculture industries. He says during Gaddafi's rule, Libya produced about 1.6 million barrels a day.
Their quality of crude is extremely high. So for production of transportation fuels like gasoline and diesel, if you lose a barrel out of Libya, you have to produce more than a barrel of heavier crude somewhere else to make up for it. Not all barrels are alike, and a Libyan barrel is more equal than others.
But not much is getting to market these days.
Less and less, that's the problem. In fact, it seems that exports out of a port called Marsa El Hariga, which was a very important port, appear to have stopped. And as a result of that, the Libyans are turning to crudes that they were exporting to serve their own needs, so that's lesser exports there.
The port closed after just reopening last month. But even when Marsa El Hariga was open, April exports averaged just 167,000 barrels a day. With the port closed, exports should drop further.
It can't get much worse in terms of supply. I mean, if you're down to under 200,000 barrels a day, which is what it looks like right now, you could easily go to zero.
Asked whether Platts knows who's in charge of Libya's oil sector, Kingston says,
no, we don't, and nobody's really in charge of the oil fields. And it's not just a question of the fields, really, it's a question of the ports. The fields are located miles away from any kind of population centers. So the issue here is the logistical system that's needed to export this oil. That is what is in turmoil as a result of there's no central government and various rebel groups are in charge of some of the port facilities. So that's the problem.
In March, a militia group had attempted to sell some of the country's oil. They loaded it on a tanker, which was thought to be destined for North Korea. Libya's weak government was opposed to the sale. Its efforts to seize the tanker failed, reportedly because of rough seas and bad weather. It also had threatened to bomb the vessel. It never got the chance. President Obama ordered U.S. Navy SEALs to commandeer the ship. Kingston says the militia had little chance of success anyway, since it was not part of the international banking or shipping systems. The longer-term concerns in Libya, he says, are the country's underground oil reservoirs. These are porous or fractured rock formations that contain oil or natural gas. There's a good chance they're being damaged.
Oil reservoirs are kind of a fragile thing, and they need tender, loving care at all times. If you shut in production, it tends to damage the reservoir. So even if democracy broke out tomorrow and everybody was peaceful in that country, it's highly unlikely that you're going to get back up to the level that you were pre-Gaddafi overthrow anytime soon.
Platts is also monitoring developments in South Sudan, which has been mired in conflict since December.
There is a place in South Sudan called Unity State, and production there remains shut in. That probably has taken 40 to 50,000 barrels a day off of the market. So every barrel matters, particularly when markets are relatively tight, which they are. But South Sudan is just yet one more country in a lineup of countries that are racked by some level of strife that has tightened the world oil supply. Libya is at the top of that list.
Kingston says Sudan's oil production has not been affected by the South Sudan conflict. Production remains around 50 to 60,000 barrels a day. Other countries where various problems recently affected oil production include Iran, Venezuela, and Syria. The conflict there has removed about 250,000 barrels a day off the market.
So when you add up all those, it's a real murderer's row of problems. Luckily, the United States and Canada have continued to increase their production, particularly the U.S., and that has softened the blow.
Kingston says the U.S. has been able to sharply boost oil production due to techniques that extract oil from shale deposits. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Italy says it has rescued around 2,500 asylum seekers from the Mediterranean over a 24-hour period, most of them from North Africa. The Navy said today 157 children were among the migrants who had been brought to shore since yesterday, many of them in overcrowded boats. Officials say good weather conditions apparently prompted the asylum seekers to make the perilous journey. Italy is a main gateway to Europe for African and Middle Eastern migrants seeking to escape war, poverty, and political turmoil. The country has been reeling from the large influx of migrants who have arrived this year. On Tuesday, the International Organization of Migration said more than 40,000 people had risked crossing the Mediterranean during the first 5 months of this year, close to the total number for all of 2013. Italy has been demanding that the European Union do more to help police Mediterranean waters. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Italy says it has rescued around 2,500 asylum seekers from the Mediterranean during a 24-hour period, most of them departing from North Africa. And after killing nearly 300 people, Boko Haram militants are holding whole villages in northern Nigeria hostage. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
There's relief in store for women in Kenya who suffer from the painful and often embarrassing obstetric condition called fistula. The Fistula Foundation, a U.S.-based organization dedicated to treating the condition, announced recently that it received a $2 million grant to treat the condition in Kenya. The new program, called Action on Fistula, is funded by the pharmaceutical company Astellas Pharma Europe Limited. The international organization says it's the largest single grant they have ever received and the biggest corporate commitment ever made to fistula treatment. The program will treat 1,200 women in Kenya with life-changing surgery. In addition, it could serve as a model for comprehensive fistula treatment in other countries. Kate Grant is the CEO of Fistula Foundation. She explained what causes the condition and how it impacts a woman, both physically and emotionally.
Obstetric fistula is a childbirth injury. It's the result of unrelieved obstructed labor, the kind of labor that if women were giving birth in the United States or another industrialized developed country would likely have a C-section and she wouldn't end up with a fistula. But for millions of women that give birth at home without access to emergency obstetric care, this injury can result. It basically is an injury that leaves women incontinent. That's the bad news. The good news is, though, surgery in the hands of a literally trained surgeon, the holes that create the incontinence can be sewn up and the woman can be given back her health.
Tell us about this new program in Kenya, Action on Fistula.
We are so thrilled. We've just kicked off a partnership last month in May with Astellas Pharmaceutical out of Europe. And what it is we are going to be spending 1.5 million euros, which is a little over $2 million, over 3 years targeting to Kenya exclusively. And what we've got is really a three-pronged approach. One, we're going to be treating women with this injury. We hope to treat at least 1,200 women in that 3 years. We're going to be training fistula surgeons through FIGO, which is the French acronym for the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics. And we're going to be pursuing really quite robust outreach efforts to encourage women that are living in remote rural areas that may not know that treatment exists and that treatment's available to them for free in this case, to seek treatment at facilities throughout Kenya. Part of the design of the program with both the robust outreach program as well as the surgeon training is that we will get more surgeons trained to confront this issue in coming years as well. So it's both the short term and the long term that we hope this program, Astellas Action on Fistula, will have an impact.
You talked about the physical aspects of the condition of fistula. What are some of the emotional and psychological effects of the condition?
The physical problem, incontinence, tends to unfortunately have far broader implications for a woman's mental health than one might suspect if you live in a developed country. often these women are ostracized because of the leaking of bodily waste, urine and feces, sometimes feces, almost always urine, and without often hot running water and products that we would have in a developed country, depend pads or something like that to take care of it. The women, again, are too often ostracized, frequently left by their husband. The hospital in Ethiopia that's done the most of these surgeries documents that 90% of the women that enter the hospital for treatment are clinically depressed, which is understandable if you've been left by a husband and ostracized by your community. But this is, again, where treatment can make all the difference, because a woman that goes through treatment often is in a ward with other women with this injury, starts to feel not alone from the minute she gets there, but then also the treatment itself leads to health and return mental health as well.
Though this program, Action on Fistula, focuses on women in Kenya, how will it help other women in developing countries?
Our hope, certainly, with this program is that it provides us a model where we've got results that we can measure and demonstrate to others so that we can use this sort of go deep model in a country beyond Kenya. That what we do in Kenya can serve as a model for us going deep with more resources, integrated surgeon training, outreach, and treatment.
That was Kate Grant, CEO of the Fistula Foundation. She spoke with me from San Jose, California.
The White House says U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke briefly at D-Day commemoration ceremonies in France, despite disagreements over Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. The White House said the two men had an informal conversation today that lasted 10 to 15 minutes during a lunch hosted by French President François Hollande. Earlier, President Obama paid tribute to World War II veterans at a ceremony marking the 70th anniversary of the D-Day invasion that led to the defeat of Nazi Germany. In a speech at Omaha Beach on the coast of Normandy, France, Mr. Obama hailed the troops, whom he said gave so much for the survival of liberty at its moment of maximum peril. About 160,000 Allied troops parachuted or waded onto the beaches of Normandy on June 6, 1944, in what was the largest sea assault in military history. Though about 4,500 died by the end of the day, the operation eventually led to an Allied victory across Europe. In his speech, President Obama praised the veterans who took part in D-Day for changing the course of human history. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000, and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.
VOA Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Italy says it has rescued around 2,500 asylum seekers from the Mediterranean over the past 24 hours. And Boko Haram militants are said to be occupying villages in northern Nigeria. Coming up, we have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, we look at East Africa's fashion industry. I'm Kim Lewis with Uhaya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're tipping off again with pro basketball.
Kim, let's tip off with game one of the National Basketball Association Finals. The San Antonio Spurs defeated the visiting Miami Heat Thursday night, 110-95. VOA's Tati Abeje tells us more.
By all measures, the game in San Antonio was close during the first half. At halftime, the score was San Antonio Spurs 54 and Miami Heat 49. Then came the second half. First, the air conditioning at the AT&T Center went off. The fans and the players were all sweating. But even with the sweltering heat, the Miami Heat literally took over the game during the third and early fourth quarters. They forced 23 turnovers and scored 28 points off the miscues. The Heat looked like they were going to take Game 1. Then, well into the fourth quarter, LeBron James limped off to the sidelines because of leg cramps. Many see his departure as a turning point to the game. Before his departure, LeBron had helped his team come within 2 points of the Spurs. In all, he played a total of 33 minutes and scored a game-high 25 points. Dwayne Wade had 19 points, and Chris Bosh scored 18 points. After LeBron left the court, the Spurs extended their lead by 13 points. The final score was Spurs 110, Heat 95. After the game, Miami Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra expressed how hard it was to see LeBron suffer.
I think it felt like a punch in the gut when you see your leader limping like that back to the bench. But at the same time, we still had an opportunity to make plays going down the stretch. And, they made, obviously, the biggest plays in the last 5 minutes.
The Spurs took advantage of the Heat's mishap and every opportunity they got. Tim Duncan scored 21 points and grabbed 10 rebounds. Manu Ginobili had 16 points and 11 assists off the bench. Tony Parker, despite the ankle injury, had 19 points and 8 assists. San Antonio Spurs head coach Greg Popovich expressed his feelings about the air conditioning failure.
I think it was probably tough on both teams. Players were pretty dead. So we try to, get guys in and out a little bit more than we usually do. It kind of screws up the rhythm a little bit, but it was mighty hot out there.
Popovich said despite the intense heat in the arena, his team played well, adding that the Spurs need to stop turning the ball over. The Heat now go back to the drawing board to determine what adjustments they need to play better in Game 2. Coach Eric Spoelstra is confident his team will do better and prevail in Game 2. LeBron James' health will remain a major factor as the Heat look forward to the remaining games. Game 2 takes place Sunday night in San Antonio, Texas. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's Tati Abeje.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Just come out and play with me.
Game on, sports fans. We're now only 6 days away until the kickoff of the Football World Cup in Brazil. The host country, winners of a record 5 World Cup titles, will play Croatia in the opening match in Sao Paulo. Brazil's head coach, Luiz Felipe Scolari, says projections made by him and his staff show Brazil will play neighbor and South American rival Argentina in the final. Scolari says he and the other Brazilian coaches analyzed the tournament's bracket, and they anticipate playing Lionel Messi in Argentina in the title match July 13th in Rio de Janeiro. George Vesey is a longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper. George has written a new book titled 8 World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. As the title indicates, George has covered the last 8 World Cups: Spain 1982, Mexico 1986, Italy 1990, USA 1994, France 1998, Japan, South Korea 2002, Germany 2006, and South Africa 2010. With 5 African squads, Algeria, Ghana, Nigeria, Cameroon, and Ivory Coast, getting ready for Brazil 2014, George comments on the chances of an African team getting past the quarterfinals for the first time, either in Brazil or at a future World Cup.
In my opinion, the future is open. That anything is possible in the future, that an African team, particularly because we've seen in our working lifetime, we've seen the influx, the importance of African players in Europe. Guys with African passports playing in Europe, England, France, Germany, all over the place, and for the clubs. So they are getting the experience, and they're good enough. They deserve it. It's the future. But African teams, to be perfectly blunt about it, often run into trouble when they are formed for the World Cup because the system is there are coaches brought in from the outside, and very often there are the bonus system, the payment system doesn't work. I've seen players disgruntled during the World Cup because they weren't being paid, because they weren't getting, or conditions weren't great or whatever. So it's still a work in progress. Many of these guys live outside the country, are recalled, don't see their own teammates from one time to another, and the African teams are still somewhat of a pickup situation. And for all that, in the time that I've been covering, starting in 82 and 86, African teams, sometimes they'd get bad luck. I mean, you count Algeria as an African team in 82 with that bad luck with Germany, West Germany, and Austria. But by 90, when you had Cameroon come in with Roger Miller, what a wonderful trip. And they were the first ones to get as far as the quarterfinals, and it was a wonderful time. I mean, to see a guy like Miller playing, and they brought in the coach. I think they had a Russian coach that year. But to see all the good things, Senegal in 2002, Senegal going into the big stadium in Seoul and knocking off the defending champions. Now, France was really in trouble, wasn't playing well. But African teams have given a lot of trouble I think of Nigeria in 94 giving Italy trouble. So the African teams are there where they are a factor in the group round, in the round of 16. Getting beyond the quarterfinals might still be a work in progress. I was casting around for, somebody said, come up with the names of 7 players to watch during the World Cup. Well, it's easy enough to say Cristiano Ronaldo or blah, 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 but Messi and Neymar and so on. One of the 7 names that I put in there was Didier Drogba.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
I saw Drogba will himself in his last game, his last tournament for Chelsea before he moved on. I saw him carry Chelsea on his back. I mean, the man was no kid even a few years ago and was able to play the full field, a real footballer. He was coming back on defense, helping out Cech and all of his defender guys, and then he was moving up forward and calling for the ball. Now, this was a man, well into his 30s, and I just feel like if Roger Miller could do it at, you know, whatever he was, 38, 39, 40 back in 1990, I would love to see this great, strong-minded, talented player like Didier Drogba have one burst in the World Cup and carry the Ivory Coast along for a while.
That's George Vesey, longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper and the author of a new book, Eight World Cups, My Journey Through the Beauty and Dark Side of Soccer. And George was talking with VOA from New York. The U.S. men's national soccer team will host African champion Nigeria Saturday in the southern U.S. city of Jacksonville, Florida. It's the final friendly World Cup warm-up match for both teams ahead of Brazil 2014. The Americans are coming off a 2-1 victory over Turkey in another friendly, while the Nigerians played a scoreless draw against Greece. VOA's Bernard Schussman attended the USA team's recent media day in New York City, and he filed this report.
Coach Jurgen Klinsmann and team captain Clint Dempsey were center stage. Klinsmann, a former star German player and coach, was named head U.S. coach in 2011 and guided the Americans to their seventh straight World Cup berth. He has great confidence, despite being drawn into the so-called World Cup group of death that includes second-ranked Germany, third-ranked Portugal, and 38th-rated Ghana.
A very difficult draw. It's a tough group, but we are expected and we expect from ourselves to do well. Now, we expect to go into the knockout stage, so we got to figure out a way to do that. That's what we're working on. We believe that we can absolutely go into the next round. Will it be tough games, tight games? Absolutely, that's what a World Cup is about.
Clint Dempsey is a star forward and commands the respect of his teammates. He calls being named captain of the U.S. team a huge honor.
Anytime you can go into a World Cup and be the captain for your country is something that's very special and you'll never forget. But, during this World Cup qualifying process, once Jurgen named me captain, just try to do the best that I can to lead in the way that I know how to.
Dempsey's American teammates also met the media and were asked about their chances. They were optimistic and looking forward to the challenge in Brazil. Coach Klinsmann took a realistic approach to what lies ahead.
Germany is expected to win the World Cup. I don't think that we expect now us to win the World Cup, but definitely we want to go far. We want to do well.
The U.S. soccer team opened its campaign in Natal, Brazil on June 16th against Ghana, the team that knocked the Americans out of the previous two World Cups. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
Thanks, Bernard. Finally, the Black Stars of Ghana will have the youngest side among the 32 teams named for the World Cup in Brazil. The Black Stars have an average age of 24.9 years compared to Argentina, who have the oldest with an average age of 28.4 years. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Coming up, our series on poaching in Africa. And next, we look into East Africa's fashion industry. But first, some music. Here is Mani Martin of Rwanda with Yoba Yoba.
Batatu twibera mu mataba twiragira inkazi wacu akadukamira yera tukanywa tukanyurwa tukitetera mu guru muridwe akabina jorwa umukuriti akabina rumikwa na ngi umuto muribo maze kumugabo daterwa kundi mwana wa senge
yobayo
haye
yobayo mwana wa mama tuwe mmo
Tangira kuryana byato nato bazo tubonye bikamurenga bikamuyobera bikamushobera sogokuru yaje kuducira umugani nako numufindo mbambaroga afata inkone eshatu arazibangikanya azibohesha umurungu ukomeye ati bana banjye mumaze kuba bagabo ngaho nimuvunaguriza inkoni ndeba bana banjye muri twe arazingira zimuna niyazikikiriza ubuheta nangiuye ture nizana nkwereke araho dufatanije twazivunagura inkoni zitubera ibamba ziratunanira Azifata, azikuraho wa murunga Arazikunyagura imwe ku yindi Tukwara tugira tumumaze kubona abana banjye Nimuguma hamwe ntawuzabatera Nimuguma kuryana bazabavunagura nk'izi nkoni
Ayi mama we Ayi mama we Ayi mama we Ayi mama we Ayi mama we
Manny Martin of Rwanda with his hit song Yoba Yoba.
Well, China gets a lot of the blame for buying the ivory taken from Africa's dying herds of elephants, but conservationists and government officials in Washington say America is also a big market for illegal ivory. Observers say President Barack Obama seems determined to see the U.S. play a role in saving Africa's declining elephant population. VOA's William Eagle reports.
China embarked this year on a major campaign to persuade ivory lovers to get out of the habit of buying ivory carvings. That was big news several months ago when television cameras showed bulldozers in Guangzhou crushing tons of elephant tusks confiscated from smugglers. China's campaign continues with the broadcast of a public service announcement against poaching with former National Basketball Association player Yao Ming. The announcement shows the towering 7.5-foot-tall athlete looking down with sadness at a butchered elephant carcass on a Kenyan savanna. Brooke Darby says there should be more campaigns like China's in many countries. Darby is Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, the U.S. agency that has taken on the poaching issue as a part of a global crime wave.
I think we focus a lot on the problem of demand being focused in Asia, but in fact, the United States is a major consumer of wildlife products, so we have some work to do here as well. We're right up there. One of the things that we've learned is that often consumers don't realize that the animal dies when the tusks or the horn are taken, and therefore these trinkets that they've picked up that are made of ivory actually result, you know, were a function of an animal dying in the field.
John Calvelli of the Wildlife Conservation Society says the United States is one of the largest users of ivory in the world. Probably, he says, one of the top five.
I will tell you, take a walk on the streets of New York and you will find ivory for sale. And you realize studies have been done that show that probably about one-third of the ivory in the United States comes from illegally killed elephants.
John Webb is a former prosecutor of wildlife crimes for the U.S. Justice Department and a member of the President's Advisory Committee on Wildlife Crime. He confirms the United States is a huge market for ivory fueled by internet sales. For years, U.S. laws prohibited the sale of ivory taken from elephants killed after the CITES Treaty was signed in 1973. But it was difficult to tell the age of the ivory in a store window. Calvelli says there are efforts to pass a moratorium on all ivory sales in New York State. Greater impact may come from President Obama's announcement of a ban on all ivory sales within the United States. The new regulation, which prohibits the trade of any item that contains ivory of any age, is being criticized by antique dealers. If strictly enforced, it could end the sale of certain chess pieces, the handles of revolvers, letter openers, piano keys, and the bows of some violins. Since President Obama issued an executive order creating a 17-agency task force to combat wildlife trafficking, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has prosecuted several cases of black market trade in rhino horns. A Canadian art import and export firm doing business in Cameroon and the United States was fined $100,000 for shipping parts of 21 elephants to Ohio. The United States government has become a leader in international efforts to end poaching and the international shipment and sales of illegal ivory. The U.S. Agency for International Development has funded regional alliances of conservation and law enforcement agencies, such as Asia's Regional Response to Endangered Species Trafficking, or ARREST, in Bangkok, where there have been some successful busts. Webb has watched the growth of these regional networks with great interest.
Cops don't trust each other. I mean, that's the bottom line. And so one of the reasons why you create these wildlife enforcement networks is it's much easier to work with somebody who you've met face-to-face and know than it is some faceless law enforcement official from a foreign country.
More attention is being paid to judicial systems in African countries where wildlife crimes may not be punished. But Webb says government officials and the courts of many African countries represent the biggest challenge to the termination of the poaching of wildlife. However, the challenge of saving Africa's elephants is likely more complex than anyone yet realizes. Varun Vira is an analyst at C4 Ads and the co-author of Ivory's Curse, The Militarization and Professionalization of Poaching. Vira cites the work of the World Bank and others who draw a correlation between poaching and the long-term impacts of poverty, hunger, and infant mortality. Some of these observers note that poaching has been going on in Africa for centuries. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
When it comes to locally made clothes, East Africa lags behind other regions. It's overwhelmed by the availability of cheap foreign-made imports. But now the producers of New York Fashion Week are helping to kickstart the region's fashion industry through a series of runway shows. They argue that the industry could create thousands of jobs, especially for women. Hilary Hewler has more from Kampala.
Like hundreds of entrepreneurs in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, Emily Walusimbi is in the business of fashion. She sells clothes from a small shop on the side of the road where women of all ages come to look stylish.
They want to go with the trend. What they see in magazines, what they see on the net, that's what they want, not what their parents wear.
But all Walusimbi's clothes are secondhand, made in Europe. And the trends her customers want to follow come from Europe as well, she says.
If there's a new style in Europe, they get on the net, and so they say, I want that one.
Unlike in West or Southern Africa, East African women get almost all their fashion from Europe and America, says Ugandan fashion designer Gloria Wavamuno. Even local tailors shy away from creating their own designs, she says.
We tailor Western styles, so we copycat rather than innovate.
But this year, a group of producers and designers is hoping to kickstart a homegrown fashion industry they say would benefit the regional economy. Backstage at a recent Kampala fashion show, dozens of models and stylists put the final touches on flowing robes, chunky metallic jewelry, and African-patterned tunics. LDJ Productions, the producers of New York Fashion Week, are helping to stage a series of runway events throughout the region to showcase local designers and attract sponsorship. They're also planning workshops in business development, marketing, and social media. CEO Lori DeJong says the fashion industry can help with development by boosting commerce and creating jobs, especially for women.
In New York, we do Fashion Week in Lincoln Center twice a year. And just in the neighborhood that we do Fashion Week in, it brings in $82 million in revenue. So the potential here is enormous.
But, she says, East Africa has a long way to go. Attitudes are slowly starting to change, says Wavamuno, as East Africans come to see fashion as art.
I feel locally we are just starting to understand or appreciate our own local artists and understand that, yes, they can be what you're wearing. You don't have to feel clothes are only made internationally.
But with so many secondhand Western clothes available in markets and shops, some costing less than a dollar, building a business is an uphill battle. The solution, she says, may need to come from politicians. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In light of Madagascar's successful 2013 elections and installation of a new government, the United States has lifted restrictions on provision of foreign assistance to the Indian Ocean island nation. The restrictions had been put in place following a coup d'etat in 2009. President Ari Rajaonarimampiam's taking office and naming a new cabinet ends a political crisis that damaged the nation's economy and cost it much support in the international community. Although the United States joined other nations in cutting off direct aid to Madagascar's government, our country remained the nation's largest partner, providing more than $61 million in food security, health, and disaster assistance in 2013 alone. Approximately 150 Peace Corps volunteers served there as well. As the African Union now has lifted its suspension of Madagascar's membership, and the United States is removing all remaining coup-related aid restrictions, President Rajaonarimampiam has been invited to attend the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit to be held in Washington this summer. Madagascar's return to democratically elected government represents an opportunity for it to make progress on strengthening democratic rights, combating corruption, and rebuilding its economy. We look forward to working productively with the nation's new leaders as they work to secure a democratic and prosperous future for the Malagasy people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
VOA Africa Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.